I find this to be an awkward moment. I have affinity for Joshua, and I'll share a little bit of that here in a moment, but I thought this morning, as I was getting things ready here, as I normally do on Sunday morning, I was refilling our oil candles, and I dropped some oil on my pants, and so I had these two big spots on my pants. Becky came to the rescue with some shout, but there's still some spots there. But it's not as bad. I'm not as embarrassed as I was my very first charge conference. At my very first charge conference in that little church north of Abilene, Texas, at Holly, Texas. I'm sure y'all are all very familiar with that metropolis. We stood there in that sanctuary, and I introduced our superintendent who was going to lead us in the charge conference, and we did a couple of things. We sang a song and had a prayer and then got started. But I went to sit down after we got officially started the session of the conference, and I sat down, and as you sit down, you can look down, and that's when I discovered, well, the fly on my pants was down. I was unzipped. At least my shirt tail wasn't sticking out, That, I'm sure, is not the worst moment, but who wants to stand here and tell those kind of things over the last 45 years? Joshua was a man who was selected to follow Moses. Big shoes. And at the end of Deuteronomy, you have Moses climbing, in that last chapter, he climbs to the top of Mount Nebo, where he is able from there to look in the distance and see the promised land. A land that he would never get to enter himself. And so God appointed Joshua to fill those shoes. And he told Joshua, "You and all these people, get ready to cross the Jordan into the land I'm about to give to these Israelites. And I will give you every place you set your feet." Wow. What a daunting role. Moses was of some stature among the people. He had guided them through the wilderness all those 40 years, and he had led them out of Egypt, and his person and his leadership cast a long shadow. Could Joshua ever measure up to Moses in the eyes of the people? And if that wasn't enough, it would be one thing to lead an army to invade and take the land. It's quite another that he had to also, along with that, bring along a whole population of women and children and elderly and livestock and all their belongings, the booty that they had taken out of Egypt with them and that they had collected in the wilderness. They didn't have any storage buildings. They didn't go rent a storage space somewhere. Well, it was a great honor. Nice title. But Joshua's heart must have wondered, am I the guy for this job? And he knew that some of the things that awaited them were going to be huge in the way of challenge and difficulty. And so he was wondering there, is he? It depicts him there by the stream, by the Jordan, alone. Thinking, meditating. How are we going to do this? How am I going to do this? And how gracious and merciful is our Heavenly Father, because he could see Joshua's heart, and his mind, and all the concerns he had, all the doubts. And so in a quiet moment, he gave Joshua an exhortation, a word of encouragement, part of which is actually on this plank here in front of you, this sitting on the easel. It's been hanging on my wall for a number of years in the study here. It's been long my life verse. Actually, when God spoke to me about using this verse, really also about me in my role as pastor and the kind of pastor I would be, I read it out of this Bible. You may notice this is not the same one I normally read out of. And in the ninth verse of Joshua 1 in this Bible, it's New American Standard Version, it says, "Have I not commanded you?" He'd already told him once before, at least, "Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do all the law that I've given Moses, my servant, and don't turn it right or left," he said this at one point. But then he says again, "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous." It doesn't give you a whole lot of leeway there, does it? You're going to be strong and courageous or else, right? "Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." It was a word meant to encourage and instill confidence. Come on, Joshua, I'm with you. You're not alone in this. And just as it was for me a word of encouragement, it is a word for you of encouragement. It is a word meant to instill that same confidence that he goes with you. It's a very apt word when you think about it for all us itinerant Methodist preachers. You know, we go from place to place and we cross a lot of different Jordans, if you will. And God says, "Be strong and courageous, for I go with you wherever you go." Which is a good thing, because we make the vow that we'll go wherever we're sent. And we're called to lead a people through what can be overwhelming challenges. Sometimes we're able to see a promised land, if you will, that God is calling us to lead the people to. It's truly an adventure. And what I've learned about adventures in these years of life is that, did you ever see an adventure that was boring? Did you ever see an adventure that was easy? Why, no, it's not an adventure if it's easy. Adventures means it's a challenge. So, 10 years and 6.5 months ago, I got this phone call. It was my superintendent. And he said, "Brian, we want you to consider something." These are after all the appointments have been made, right? I mean, I have the full assurance, I think, that we'll be at Snyder another year. Why, no. Well, maybe. He wanted me to consider us moving to Farmington. And as I told someone just Friday night, They were in our home, family were, and they asked, well, is this going to be your forever home? That's a good thing to ask somebody who's moved 27 times. And I said, well, I think we are. We're sure not going to plant any trees. Now, the joke about that is every time we've planted a tree, guess what? We've moved. We're going to overcome that one, okay? Gosh. Heavens to Murgatroyd. Anyway, so he said, we want you to consider moving to Farmington. And I thought, what? Farmington? I mean, I knew a little bit about Farmington. I knew where it was. I knew at the time that our oldest daughter had moved here ahead of us. She was transferred by Lowe's. She was in management with Lowe's and transferred here to work here. And that was the reason I listened to the rest of the conversation. I thought, what? It must be something God's doing, maybe, because at least this time he's moving us toward family rather than away from family. So, we came in June of 2015. And at first glance, you know, it could have maybe been fairly easy to say, well, what needed to change? I mean, our first Sunday here, we had about almost 300 people in attendance. I mean, what need would we have to risk crossing any Jordan to move into some new land? Some of you may remember that I interviewed 32 different people, those folk whose names were given me as recognized leaders in the church. And so I did those interviews, and that revealed a lot, because in those interviews I asked the same 14 questions. So I had my baseline. I had that one consistent variable was the questions they were asked. It's how they responded to those questions that gave me insight and also history of the church. You know how sometimes we talk about an elephant in the room, right? And you know, that's the one thing that nobody wants to talk about, but everybody knows is there, right? Well, those interviews and some other sources for information revealed not just one elephant, but 9 elephants. All of them huge. And so I said, Lord, you called the wrong fella. What were you doing calling me here? So I formed a Joel committee, because Joel tells us that your old men will dream visions or have visions, and women dream dreams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I made a Joel committee so we could look at our context, our situation, and to see where we really were and to discern where God might lead us to go forward, what Jordans we would cross, how would we, well, in truth, eat some of those elephants. Or maybe herd them out, I don't know, but we were going to tackle them one way or another. And that began a journey to get to and eventually cross a Jordan for us as a church. Well, as Joshua knew, that's easier said than done. We had the direction. We had some things that we needed to attend to and be aware of. But it's not easy. And being an agent of change, being a leader who's actually going to take an organization or a church somewhere, brings challenges and burdens. There were the indestructible walls of Jericho that Joshua and the people faced. There was the various pagan tribes that they would be in conflict with and had to subdue or actually force out of the promised land. And that was just a few of the things that were outside of their group of a couple of million people. There was also the problem within, you know, because as people are, they will question.
Are you sure we're going the right way? Why are we going here? Why are we going?
And there's some of those who would start to go back to Egypt movement. You've heard of that one, right? It was better in Egypt, they said. At least there, we wouldn't die. And then there are those who just gripe, and there's those who will drag their feet. Some will outright rebel. And then there are just some that will say, you know what? I don't want any of this. I'm out of here. It's difficult to overcome the inertia of a desire that of people who want to remain comfortable, who like to be where they are. And that's true of all of us. In truth, it's a rare person that just seeks adventure all the time. In fact, I would argue that for a lot of those folk who do that all the time, really, that is they're comfortable. You know what I mean. That's where they are comfortable. They're not comfortable with just dealing with everyday life. And the truth is also that we're for a visionary, a person who's able to see the possible, to see what could be, to see where God is leading a congregation or wants to lead a congregation, is, while it's much easier for them to see that, it remains a mystery to others. And so you have to communicate and share that with them. And leading a congregation through such a delicate process or transition toward a new vision is challenging, and it's also depleting. It drains you. And sometimes it's wounding. Pastoral leaders often find themselves trying to maintain the ship's heading against the wave and the storm, against the cross currents of opposition or fighting the tides of the cultural and historical context. That has never been more true than it has been in the last 5 or 6 years than it had been for 1,000 years. Part of the church leader's role is to communicate, to help and support the pastor in that time, to come alongside, to be a part of the work. And so they can carry some of the challenge, but they can't carry necessarily all the burdens. Because you see, pastors, we're bound by confidence. So sometimes people say to us things that can't be shared with other folk. And sometimes we have to respond in a way that makes you think, why is he doing that? When the truth is, a pastor's responding to somebody or to something and trying to negotiate, trying to pave a way for grace. And sometimes spiritual honor just necessitates it in a way that where pastors have to weather the opposition, they have to weather the blows that come, even attacks that come. And there is this consumer mindset that long ago took hold in our churches. And today makes for pastors who find themselves taking heart in Jesus' experience in John 6:66. Now you may say, what is that? Well, that's where we see John's comment about what that was a defining moment, a turning point, because he says, from this time, many disciples turned back and no longer followed Jesus. And pastors experience that. They experience times when they know when they're a knower that they're doing the right thing, that they're leading a church in the right direction, but people don't want to go. It's too hard. Too much of an adventure. And so I just share these because it would be very helpful to you and to Jeremy, your next pastor, that you understand this. Because these dynamics will exist for him as well. As pastors like Jesus and Paul after Jesus, in our attempt to be faithful, we sometimes can only say, as Paul says in Ephesians 6, stand your ground after you have done everything, stand. Now, did you notice something? Let me ask you, does it sound adventuresome to stand? No, I mean, we don't depict it that way in the cinema, do we? We see adventurers going striking forward, going after it, rather than standing. And believe me, there are seasons when there is nothing left to do for you or for me other than to stand. We're not giving up ground, but we're not taking any ground. We're standing, and we're standing for truth. And the blows come, and the questions are raised, the doubts are voiced, integrity is questioned, ability is seriously doubted. But you stand. Sometimes being a faithful Christian leader means, just as it did for Jesus, that as you are faithful and stand, the journey leads you to a cross and leads you to nails. And I noticed something in the Gospel of John, that the closer you get to the cross, the smaller the crowd. The closer you get to the cross, the smaller the crowd. So when you see the crowds dwindling, don't necessarily suspect that they're not headed the right direction. Might well be going the right direction. As a matter of fact, I've taken note of the fact that there are a number of pastors who have chosen to go a direction where they've changed course for the church, where they were at one time this very large church and they were a mile across, but they were about that deep. And they came to the realization that they were not really making disciples. They had a crowd, they had fun, but they weren't making disciples. They weren't making followers of Jesus. They weren't seeing lives really transformed. And they felt that conviction within their heart and soul and said, this cannot be. This is not what we're called to. A good memory, historical moment to remember in times like those is Martin Luther, one of the men at the forefront of the Reformation. The Reformation didn't begin with a victory yell and a revival. It began with Martin Luther's firm but quiet voice before a tribunal, where he told them that he would not recant on his biblical views, especially that view regarding justification by faith, where grace is available to all. And he said, "Here I stand. I can do no other." Joshua met that moment in his own day. It's toward the end of that book that we call Joshua. It is a statement that we often see emblazoned in our homes. It's posted on doorways. "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Well, the context of that is everybody wants to go this direction. Joshua says, "No, God's calling us to this direction, calling me, and I'm going." And there may well be a day when Jeremy says, "God's calling us here. Oh, it'd be so much easier to take a left turn." The question that you got to ask yourself then is, who are you serving? As I said, this was an awkward moment. But my heart has been for this moment, this last message that I'll share with you, at least as your pastor, is this. What does it mean for you as Riverstone, as a church body, this stuff that I've shared with you this morning, this passage, to be strong and courageous? Well, first of all, I hope you've been blessed to know that the God who told Joshua that he would strengthen him wherever he would go will do the same for you. Especially if you're going where he sent you. I mean, here at Riverstone, just becoming Riverstone, we have experienced and overcome many difficulties. We've done better than 20% of the churches in America, just in the fact that we're still here. 20% of the churches in America are gone as a result of COVID and the after effects. We're losing 7,000 of them a year. I think you're going to be here longer than a year. You'll be here next week. You've chosen vision and the unknown challenges that come with it into a new land rather than sticking around and being comfortable in the known. Second, I hope that you've been given a helpful glimpse into what it means for a pastor to lead and be your pastor. Much prayer and heartache goes into being a pastor. Third, Riverstone could not remain here. I mean, you can't remain as you are. The mission and ministry context, the mission itself demands that you move forward. Even if it means just standing against the tide. But the mission and ministry context is ever-shifting, and we're in a season now of unparalleled openness in the young who are seeking. They recognize that the well that they have been pointed to drink from is dry, it is empty. And they're wanting something for substance, for life. And friends, you and I have it as we can share the gospel, as we can share Jesus. I think there's another thing you need to know, and that is that Jeremy Bybee, your new pastor, has been told by the interview committee members that there is a willingness and that there are resources in this congregation to move forward into a new vision of ministry. And I know from the little tidbits that I've heard that he is working hard toward that. He's dreaming. He's trying to dream a God dream for you and this congregation and the ministry you will have in the future. There's some steps that he wants to take or is considering that are big steps. And I want to encourage you to do that which seems counter-instinctive. Let him. Let him. Join him. So pray for Jeremy. Pray for Ginger as she will seek to it. Support him, encourage him, love him, stand beside him. Comfort him in moments when he has he's full of doubts. I encourage you to stand with him and actively do so and sacrifice in a way where you engage with him in your prayers, your presence, your gifts, your service, and your witness. Does that sound familiar to you? Those five things? Are not those things the five things you vow to be a part and uphold this fellowship? They are. Live into those. And whatever Jordan you're being called to cross, whatever boundary lies between you and God's calling, friends, be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous. The Lord will go with you wherever you go and in whatever adventure he will take you. Amen. I told you I was going to take some license this morning. Some aspect of the sermon was that way, but I also want to share a song with you. Don, you want to come up? Tell a couple of things that go with it first. This is the Cokesbury Hymnal. Anybody recognize the Cokesbury here? Be nice to my Cokesbury. So, the Cokesbury Hymnal was printed at a very interesting time. It was printed in 1939, which is, if you got Methodist history in your veins, was a very poignant time, because that's when the Southern Church and the Northern Church reunited. And so some blessed soul at Cokesbury Publishing House decided, well, we ought to come up with a hymnal that would just be kind of something that helps tie us all together again. in song. And so they come up with the Cokesbury hymnal. Now, the interesting thing about the Cokesbury hymnal is that, friends, this was the contemporary songbook of the day. And you know what? A lot of old stodgies didn't like it. It wasn't highbrow enough. We used it every Sunday night in the church that I grew up in. And I want to share a song with you out of this one. It's, the tune is all very familiar. You'll recognize it like that. It's to the tune of Londonderry, which for you would probably, you would immediately go, "Oh, Danny Boy." Okay? But this is set to Christian lyric. There's no such thing as Christian music. There's only Christian lyric. You can curse God or praise God with your word. You're not going to do that with the music. Just a thought. But this one is set to Londonderry, above the hills of time. Don has graciously said he would accompany me, which is always an adventure. Not for me, but for Don, it's an adventure. Yes, lift Don up. I better get up here so I don't fall. Anyway, so we're going to give it a whirl, Don. Above the hills of time the cross is crowning. There as the sun when night has turned to day, and from its love's pure light is richly streaming to cleanse the heart and banish sin away. To this dear cross the eyes of men are turning. Today as in the ages lost to sight. And so for thee, O Christ, men's hearts are yearning, as shipwrecked seamen yearn for morning light. The cross, O Christ, thy wondrous love revealing, awakes our hearts as with the light of morn, and pardon o'er our sinful spirits stealing, tells us that we in thee have been reborn. Like echoes to sweet temple bells replying, our hearts, O Lord, make answer to thy love, and we will love thee with a love undying, till we are gathered to thy home above. Our ushers will come forward. We'll take up our morning offering. We always do so with hope in mind that we're giving thanks to God for all his goodness, and we're praising him. And as we do so, we come with open hearts.